This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
The Israel-Gaza war has now been going on for 9 months. The death toll, mostly Palestinian civilians, has been horrific. And in addition to the misery and destruction, the conflict threatens to destabilize the region, with attacks on Israel's northern border currently escalating. The big question is, how can this be brought to an end? Well, at the end of May, US President Joe Biden announced a proposed ceasefire deal and a partial roadmap to a new settlement. But what's in this plan to end the war? And does it stand any chance of success? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what is the Biden ceasefire plan? And how are its chances assessed in the US? David Makowski is director of the CORRECT Project on Arab-Israel Relations at the Washington Institute. David Makowski, before we look at the plan itself, can I just ask you how much effort has US diplomacy been putting into the Gaza situation?
The US has put a lot of effort into this. Bill Burns, the head of the CIA, has been really the point person for the United States. There's also been support from the White House to be part of these hostage negotiations. We saw a hostage release in November, 105 hostages were released, and there was also some prisoners released as well. That was a product of U.S.-led efforts. And then Bill Burns, I think, convened the mediators, the Egyptians, the Qataris, the Israelis, to work out a deal. And so they've had meetings, it seems like, almost nonstop. And, you know, when you're the head of the CIA, you've got a lot of other things to do. But Bill Burns found the time to, like, shuttle out to the region on a very frequent basis to try to reach this hostage deal.
So when we talk about the peace plan, which you'll go through in a moment, is it an American peace plan, or is it a peace plan essentially that was concocted between different parties at these various meetings?
These four parties, the United States, the Egyptians, the Qataris, and the Israelis, have been meeting intensely since January to find a proposal that they could converge upon. And this is an expression of what was agreed upon between the parties.
Okay, so let's talk about the plan itself. It's been written that the plan is made up of three phases. If you could talk us through them, starting with phase one, what's supposed to happen in phase one of the plan?
The first phase would be a 6-week period. There would be a full and complete ceasefire, a withdrawal of Israeli forces from all populated areas of Gaza, not necessarily of all of Gaza, but from the cities, and a release of a number of hostages. It looks like the number is 33, with a focus on the women hostages, the elderly, and the wounded. And in exchange, for the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, and I should add, many of them would be lifetime prisoners who were involved in terror against Israelis. That would be the main focus in phase one, and Palestinian civilians would be able to return to their homes, neighborhoods in all areas of Gaza, including the northern part of Gaza. And there would be a surge of humanitarian assistance as well, up to like 600 trucks a day.
Okay, so we've got to the end of phase one, done all those things, and of course...
Right, and then I should add, but during the 6 weeks already, the parties would be sitting together again. I mean, Israel and Hamas don't sit together, but the negotiators with Israel and Hamas and talk about phase two. And here's where it gets more complicated. Here was a key Israeli concession that Israel agreed to extend the 6 weeks of ceasefire as long as there's good faith negotiations. So phase two should see the release of the remainder of the hostages, and that would lead to a withdrawal.
So that would be a withdrawal of the Israelis from the remaining parts of Gaza that they were in.
Exactly. Phase three is more straightforward. If they could reach that understanding, then you'd have a major reconstruction for Gaza, as the president said, and any final remains of hostages that have been killed, they would be returned to their families in a phase three. But phase two is the sticky part. It's what would be enough that Israel would feel comfortable and confident that by withdrawal from Gaza, they are not creating a vacuum that would be filled by Hamas to go back and do the exact same things they did before October 7th. That's the core of this. And the president does say in his remarks, now I'll be straight with you, there are a number of details to negotiate to move from phase one to phase two. So this is the sticky part.
Is agreeing what phase two would look like a precondition for doing phase one?
That's what Hamas wants. Hamas's point is, I don't want to do phase one unless I have a clear timetable on phase two. And Israel doesn't want to give a timetable unless it knows that Hamas is not reconstituting itself, not rebuilding weapons, not rebuilding tunnels. And that is something where the parties are very much at odds. And that's why there's no deal.
Is the U.S. hopeful at all that it could possibly persuade Hamas into a position of agreeing to phase one without an agreement about phase two?
You know, the president has talked publicly about this and tried to get the Egyptians and the Qataris to press Hamas. So the U.S. feels like, okay, we've done what we can do, but I don't know what more we can do than what we've done.
Does the U.S. believe that the Arab states that are involved, Qatar and Egypt, are seeing this thing in the same kind of way as the administration is?
From what I'm hearing, I think Israel's very pleased that the Egyptians have been pressing Hamas to accept this Biden plan. I don't know if Qatar has pushed Hamas as much. There's going to be always issues of interpretation of what is the leverage of each of these two key players. I think it's fair to say these are the two most influential Arabs when it comes to Hamas. The question is, have they done their maximum and has it made a difference?
David Makovsky. Now I want to know how the plan plays in Israel. Anshul Pfeffer is senior correspondent for Haaretz and Israel correspondent for The Economist. Anshul Pfeffer, before we get into the Israeli response to what's been called the Biden ceasefire plan, can we just take a step back and talk about the Israeli political system, how it actually works? So can you just tell us who was in government before October the 7th and how that government changed with the Hamas attack?
The coalition which won the election back in November 22 consists of Netanyahu's Likud party, the far-right parties and the ultra-Orthodox parties. They won the election with 64 seats in the 120-member Knesset, so their majority, which was pretty small, is also dependent on all these far-right parties staying in the government. They basically had the power over Netanyahu. Following the Hamas attack on October 7, one of the centrist parties, Benny Gantz's National Unity, joined an emergency coalition. Gantz's demand was that a war cabinet would be formed to run the war effort, and he would be there along with his political partner, Gadi Eisenkot, both former chiefs of staff of the Israeli army, and the far right wouldn't be in that specific forum. They would keep the powers that they have, but they wouldn't be represented in the smaller war cabinet. And Netanyahu accepted that, and Gantz and his party joined the coalition 4 or 5 days after the war began.
And it is Gantz and Eisenkot who have just resigned from the war cabinet. Can you just take us through very briefly why they did and what it means?
Well, basically, they had both reached a conclusion that their influence over the decision-making process, over Netanyahu, over the main war policies, had been eroded. They had, I think, considerable influence in the first few months of the war, but as the war proceeded to a point where Israel needed to come up with some kind of strategy, some kind of policy, what kind of mechanism to end the war, they felt that Netanyahu wasn't including them in any kind of discussion over that policy. There isn't such a policy, and Gantz last month basically made an ultimatum. If Netanyahu doesn't present these policies that we can agree upon them, we can talk about them, then there's no point in us remaining in government.
Am I right in thinking that Gantz and Eisenkot would have been the people in the government most sympathetic to what the American administration has been trying to do?
That's true. I think that everyone in the war cabinet has been talking to the Americans. Netanyahu, the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, Eisenkot and Gantz, and they were much more open to, first of all, to just discussing with the Americans some kind of day-after strategy, which is something Netanyahu has refused to do. Certainly hasn't been prepared to talk about it openly. So, yeah, from the Americans' point of view, they lost their main allies in the Israeli war cabinet.
Right. Now, let's talk about what's been called the Biden peace plan. As David McCoskey has explained to us, actually, it is much more varied than that. In other words, the Israelis and other people were also involved in the drawing up of this peace plan, even if Mr. Netanyahu has not publicly endorsed it in that way. Is that also your understanding?
This is an Israeli proposal. It was a proposal made in the war cabinet, endorsed by the war cabinet. It was relayed to Hamas via Qatar. And when Joe Biden a few weeks ago made his speech in the White House about the plan, he also made it quite clear this is an Israeli proposal. He didn't try and take ownership of it. And I think he wanted to pin Netanyahu down to this proposal because this proposal was issued in secret. It wasn't something that was even brought to the broader Israeli cabinet where the far right partners are as well, because Netanyahu knew that, you know, they would go crazy and demand that the proposal be shelved and not be sent to Hamas. So this was done by a much smaller forum within the Israeli government. And Biden, in a sense, was outing Netanyahu on this to try and make sure that he remained committed to it.
The United States position on the state of the peace plan appears to be that it's Hamas which has not signed up yet to phase one because it wants conditions on phase two. And Israel effectively has signed up for phase one. Therefore, it's Hamas which is the block here. Is that your understanding of the situation?
From my sources, people I've spoken to who have been involved with the negotiations, the latest Israeli proposal is not that different from Hamas's previous positions a couple of months ago. Israel then, and especially Netanyahu, the Netanyahu government was less forthcoming and an agreement wasn't reached then. Now Israel's proposal, which is quite close to the previous Hamas positions, is being rejected by Hamas. Hamas are basically demanding preconditions of a full ceasefire already from the beginning, while the proposal has, first of all, a six-week truce period in which there'll be a release of a number of the hostages, and during that period, further talks on a full ceasefire and the release of all the hostages. That's where the main bone of difference is between Israel and Hamas. And from what I know of Hamas's position, their situation almost mirrors that of Israel in the sense that the Israeli government is split over this proposal. This proposal was issued by the war cabinet, but it hasn't yet been affirmed by the full cabinet, which it would need to be. Netanyahu's own position, even though he agreed to issue this proposal, isn't clear. And on the Hamas side, from what we know, the political wing of Hamas, those who are in Qatar, in Egypt, and under much more pressure from their hosts, are more open to accepting the Israeli framework, whereas the Hamas leadership in Gaza, mainly Yahya Sinwar, who controls the hostages' fate, are holding out for much more tougher demands.
Do you think that there is more that Netanyahu could easily do to try and facilitate the passage of the plan? In other words, to say things about the possibilities in phase two that would get Hamas to agree to phase one?
At present, I don't think so. I don't think that there's that much Netanyahu can do which will change Hamas's positions. He could say, yes, we'll be open to considering a full ceasefire during this first stage. That may change, though I don't think Hamas would accept that. Maybe they'll change their position, but I don't think their position is currently because Netanyahu isn't in public talking about a full ceasefire.
Anshul, the situation is even further complicated, isn't it, by the fact that in the last period, things on the Israeli northern border with Hezbollah have become more difficult and more dangerous. Is there a perception that there may be additional urgency to trying to sort out the situation in Gaza because the situation in the north is so precarious?
That is very much the position within the security establishment. They are not soft on Hamas in any way. We've seen in the last 8 months, the Israeli army, the way they've conducted the war. But they, I think, have reached the conclusion that there are diminishing returns for continuing the operation in Gaza as it is. It's not that they think that Israel's longer-term war with Hamas will go away. They think that in another year or two, there may have to be more operations against Hamas. But the situation up north against a much more formidable enemy in the face of Hezbollah, which is basically an Iranian expeditionary force nowadays, means that they do need to try and shift focus to the north. There's also the linkage that a ceasefire in Gaza will probably bring a ceasefire in the north. It doesn't mean that the prospects of war disappear, but that will also give Israel a sort of a breathing period to kind of work out what its strategies are, both in Gaza and on the northern border regarding Hezbollah. So for those reasons, yes, the Israeli army is, the general certainly, and the defense minister are much more open to some kind of a ceasefire in Gaza because of that pressure up north.
Is there a view that the far-right elements in the government will try and act to block any deal?
Yes, certainly. If in the further rounds of talks there is an agreement roughly based on the Israeli proposal with Hamas, Netanyahu will have to then, first of all, decide if he accepts it, and second of all, decide whether he's willing to risk his coalition over it, because the far right have already responded to the Israeli proposal as published by Joe Biden, that they would leave the government, they would leave the coalition, if that would become Israel's actual policy of stopping the war for a hostage agreement and accepting the possibility of a long-term ceasefire. You know, we can't say what would happen if and when we reach that point, but you know, Netanyahu is going to have to make a choice whether he takes the deal or keeps his coalition.
Anshul Pfeffer. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking how much trouble UK universities are in, the one about America's border crisis, and the one about how technology is changing warfare.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise-Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise-Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Back to the ceasefire plan, and now I want to find out what Hamas's calculations are and how the wider Arab world is responding. Joining me are Lina Khatib, Director of the Middle East Institute at SOAS, University of London, and Hussein Ibish, Senior Resident Scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Lina Khatib, can you remind us who makes the decisions in Hamas and where are they?
The main decision makers in Hamas are Yahya Sinwar, who is the Hamas leader in Gaza, as well as the Hamas leadership outside Gaza, mainly the leadership in Qatar, headed by Ismail Haniyeh. One thing to remember is that any decision taken by Hamas has to have the blessing of the leadership inside as well as outside. And so, you know, some people might think that Hamas outside doesn't represent what is happening inside, but actually there has to be alignment between the two sides regarding any political decisions for the organization.
And has anything changed in the relationship between those two elements since the attack on October the 7th?
There has been a lot of speculation about disagreements between the two sides, with some seeing that the leadership inside Gaza is not open to compromise, whereas the leadership in Qatar is more open to compromise. But ultimately, it doesn't matter because nothing will move forward unless the leadership inside agrees. And therefore, whatever the leadership in Qatar might want to do, they know they have to have full agreement with the military leadership on the ground.
Hussein Ibish, I'm going to ask you what will seem a very difficult question to answer, which is, do we know whether or not this leadership of Hamas thinks that the war has worked for them or against them?
It's clear that the Hamas leaders in Gaza feel that the war is going in the direction that they want it, and that they have the Israelis where they want them, as they told the external leaders in Qatar and Lebanon and elsewhere in a message in February. And what they mean by that is that the Israelis have fallen into the trap they laid for them. They wanted the Israelis to overreact to the October 7 attacks and come back into Gaza full bore and keep boots on the ground to serve as a lightning rod for a long-term insurgency. They would then claim credit for and claim leadership of the Palestinian National Movement on that basis.
Lina Khatib, is part of what the calculation is here about Hamas's position relative to the Palestinian Authority?
Absolutely. I mean, until October 6th, Hamas was seeing that the Palestinian Authority was heading in the direction of being on board with a Israeli-Saudi-US normalization process. And Hamas felt that its own role is being diminished in this kind of trajectory. And also, it has, for the longest time, felt that the Palestinian Authority is weak and divided and ineffective. So Hamas definitely wants to be seen as the political representative of the Palestinian people for any negotiations over the future of Palestine to be with Hamas, not the Palestinian Authority. Definitely Hamas would like to replace the Palestinian Authority altogether, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. And the rivalry between the two sides is very much part of the landscape.
Hussein Ibish, is the Hamas leadership constrained in any way by the views and reactions of the Palestinian population in Gaza itself?
A little bit, you know, in the sense that they have to care about public opinion in the long run because they are engaged in a long-term struggle with Fatah for control of the Palestinian national movement. So they do have to be wary of public opinion to some extent, but they're playing a long game here. The leadership in Gaza decided to risk their control of Gaza and everything that they had accumulated in Gaza since taking over there in 2007 to the Israeli war machine in order to get the political benefits that they thought that this war and a long-term struggle against Israel, armed struggle, would potentially provide to them. So because they're playing a long game, they're not interested in the public reaction right now. They could be put on the spot very quickly if Israel were to wrap up and leave Gaza, you know, in the very near future. Then they would have to probably face a real real questioning, a reckoning with the Palestinian public. But as long as the Israeli military hangs around, they can simply say that they are defending the nation and making the blood sacrifice and claim credit.
Lina Hatib, we've heard that the plan, which is attributed to President Biden, but which seems to be kind of rather broader than that, has several phases, of which the most concrete is the first phase, which is the six-week ceasefire. And that the sticking point appears now to be whether Hamas will agree to go ahead with phase one if you don't have agreement about what happens in phase two. But given what you and Hossein Ibish have just said, it's hard to see why they would agree to the phase one ceasefire.
If anyone has followed what the leader of Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hassan Nasrallah, said in his latest speech, and Hezbollah obviously is a very close ally of Hamas, he said, why should Hamas agree to a six-week ceasefire when this agreement means giving up one of their most valuable cards in the conflict, which is the Israeli hostages? Because the plan says that there has to be a partial release of Israeli hostages as part of the six-week ceasefire. So the way Nasrallah put it is this would simply mean Hamas losing one of its cards and then exposing itself to war resuming afterwards. And what Nasrallah said actually makes a lot of sense from Hamas's perspective. And this may well be the reason why Hamas's official response to the plan has been to set extra conditions that they want to see happen if they are to be on board with a plan. And one of the key conditions is not a six-week ceasefire, but a permanent ceasefire from the very beginning. And so it seems that Hamas is not going to be on board with this plan.
Hossein Ibish, let's talk about the other Arab interests in this. Obviously, the Qataris and Egyptians are directly involved, and the feeling has been all along that the Qataris might help gentle Hamas into a kind of different position. Do we know how the Qataris and Egyptians are feeling about the situation right now?
Yes, very anxious. The Egyptians in particular have been alarmed into the extreme red zone, if I may put it that way, because there is this long-running concern dating back to the early 50s in Egypt that Israel might try to displace the Palestinians in Gaza into Egypt, into the Sinai Peninsula or elsewhere in Egypt. And this is sort of a very old Egyptian policy nightmare. They want it to be over, and they negotiate with Hamas all the time because of that shared border between Sinai and Gaza, but they do it on an unfriendly basis. Qatar, on the other hand, I think is very concerned that its relationship with Hamas, which has been a patron-client relationship and very supportive, which hasn't changed since the October 7 attack, exposes them to a great deal of international criticism. And I think they've been trying to use the negotiations to kind of justify the fact that they continue to host the Hamas Politburo, and remain its leading external patron, and navigate a very vulnerable political situation, especially regarding the United States, by pointing out the necessity of some kind of brokering role by Qatar in hostage negotiations. I think in the long run, they may be forced to show the Hamas leadership the door, but that's not going to be the case as long as hostage negotiations go on. So, there's a good deal of anxiety, even in these countries that are directly involved in the negotiations.
And Linda Khatib, even if we got beyond phase one and into phase two and then started looking at phase three, almost all the discussion seems to mean that Arab states would be significantly involved, not just in rebuilding Gaza, but quite possibly offering oversight to whatever peace plan comes into effect. How do they feel about that, do we know?
To be honest, this is something that Arab states have been wanting to do for a very long time, because it is what the Arab Peace Initiative is about. The phase three is actually resuming the peace process. And Arab states have been willing and ready, and they have the plan. They presented it to Israel almost two decades ago, and they are still in agreement over that plan. The detail will be about who will pay for reconstruction. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect Arab states to pick up the bill, I think Israel should definitely be involved in paying for reconstruction in Gaza. But when it comes to the peace process, I think Arab states would rather see this happen, you know, as quickly as possible rather than be dragged further into this conflict, which ultimately hurts their own diplomatic positions.
I want to ask you a final question, Hossein Ibish, which is, what do you think will happen? I mean, do you think a peace plan will be agreed upon at some point in the near future?
No, I don't. Look, I think in terms of the Gaza war, the only two parties that want to keep it going at this point are the only two parties that could possibly stop it. So in other words, it's going to continue. Netanyahu has clearly calculated that this benefits him personally and politically, and he's in no mood to stop it. And he made that very clear in his response to Biden's initiative. I think the Hamas leadership, again, similarly, is more content to keep fighting. And in fact, they think that the insurgency that has begun in Gaza City, in Jabalia, in other parts of Gaza that were supposedly pacified and freed of Hamas control, but now see these little insurgent actions coming up. That's the kind of thing that they were talking about when they spoke about permanent war with Israel in the immediate aftermath of October 7th. So for them, again, just as Lina was saying, why would they agree to this 6-week pause only to set themselves up for another battering? And then in addition, they're perfectly comfortable with the way the war is going from a kind of political military point of view. As long as the Israelis are good enough to stay and provide the lightning rod for their insurgency, that works for them. So I don't see any immediate end to this, agreed end anyway, to this conflict.
Hossein Ibish there with Lina Khatib. My thanks to them and to David Makovsky and Anshul Pfeffer. And my conclusion, well, the plan is obviously going to be incredibly hard to fulfil, but no one seems to have a better one. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirstine Knight, Sally Abrahams and Ben Carter. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by Sarah Hockley. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, I'm Adam Fleming. This is going to be my 6th general election as a journalist for the BBC. Political people and campaigners love using their own language, so we thought we'd make a series for BBC Radio 4 unpicking it all. What is a manifesto? What's swing? How do opinion polls work? Who picks the candidates? That is the subject of my podcast series, Understand the UK Election, available on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.